This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. 50 years ago, U.S. President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which gave millions of blacks in many parts of the southern United States federal enforcement of the right to vote, a right they had been previously denied through literacy tests, poll taxes, and other devious mechanisms deliberately designed to disenfranchise them. The law was a milestone in the American civil rights movement, considered to be the most effective piece of civil rights legislation ever enacted in the country. But now, 50 years later, pioneers of the movement, analysts, and ordinary citizens allege that the Voting Rights Act is currently under siege. In 2013, the Supreme Court struck down a key Voting Rights Act enforcement provision that required states with histories of flagrant racial discrimination to get federal approval before changing the election procedures. By a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court found that the so-called preclearance formula used on these mostly southern jurisdictions was outdated. A month after that ruling, the state of North Carolina, formerly subjected to preclearance, enacted a combination of new rules that rolled back efforts to make voting more accessible and convenient, such as stopping pre-registering of 16 to 17-year-olds, cutting back early voting from 17 to 10 days, and other provisions. We're with us to discuss the 50th anniversary of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, as well as the modern-day challenges to it, are three distinguished analysts. Mark Lagon is the president of Freedom House. Before, he was Global Politics and Security Chair at Georgetown University's Master of Science in Foreign Service program. From 2004 to 2007, with rank of ambassador, Mark Lagon served in the Bureau of International Organization Affairs at the U.S. Department of State as Deputy Assistant Secretary. And John Greenbaum, he is the Chief Counsel and Senior Deputy Director at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. He was former head of the Voting Rights Project and worked at the Department of Justice in the Voting Rights Section. Also joining me is Chris Simpkins, Senior VOA TV reporter and author of VOA's special report, Landmark U.S. Voting Rights Law Marks 50th Anniversary. And all three gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Carol.
First, I'd like to start with you, my very own colleague, Chris Simpkins. Chris, you've been going around the country, particularly in the South, covering the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. Talk about the significance of this anniversary and how it changed voting and political representation in the United States.
Well, we had the opportunity, Carol, to travel to four states throughout the South to look back 50 years and see the kinds of things that African Americans had to go through in many communities throughout the South in order to vote. It was very eye-opening for me because I didn't know about some of the things that they had to sacrifice, including trying to register to vote. They would be asked questions like how many bubbles in a bar, how many jelly beans in a jar. They had to pay poll tax, which were extraordinary amount of money at the time. So we got a sense of the struggle, but it was great significance to get this law enacted because it changed really the electorate in this country. It granted millions of African Americans the right to vote and gave federal enforcement to the 15th Amendment of the Constitution. And as soon as the act became law, overnight, people started registering to vote. And by the end of 1965, there were 250,000 new black registered voters in this country. So it was very impactful, very swift impact.
Turning to you, Mark Lagon, president of Freedom House, one of the oldest human rights organizations here in the United States. Talk about the significance from your point of view.
Well, it was very much on my mind when I came to be president of Freedom House that our job is to assist people in civil society fighting for their rights around the world, and the United States needs to be an exemplar. I found a photograph of Martin Luther King and then before being Congressman John Lewis as a civil rights activist convening a meeting several months before the Voting Rights Act at Freedom House's headquarters, and it's appropriate for us to see the progress that has been made. It required the federal government to push states and to look at that norm of states' rights and recognize when African Americans were being intimidated. And instruments were being used to block their right to vote, the government stepped in, and we've made progress.
Now I'd like to turn to our other guest, John Greenbaum, Chief Counsel and Senior Deputy Director at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. For your perspective, John, and we note also that not only did it enfranchise black voters who were denied the vote, but in addition, not only did black voter registration soar, but also the number of black elected officials has actually exploded since 50 years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, the right to vote is preservative of all other rights, and really African Americans and other minorities, by not being able to participate in the democracy in areas of the country before 1965, had no access to power. And what the Voting Rights Act has done over the last 50 years is provided everybody with the opportunity to be able to register and vote, with some exceptions that get into of continued problems today, as well as eventually to elect their candidates of choice. And that's played a key role in having African Americans elected to all different levels of positions across the country, including now, of course, the president.
Well, now let's take a look at some of the current obstacles that we're seeing. Back to you, Chris Simpkins, my VOA colleague. What are the current challenges to the 1965 law, especially the Supreme Court ruling of 2013, to which I alluded in the introduction?
Well, when we traveled around the country, we talked to a lot of people in various states who are concerned about the restrictions to voting, such as producing a government-issued ID. We found instances in Wisconsin where people are not able to get that ID, and for one reason or another do not have a birth certificate in order to obtain that ID. So that was one of the issues. Another one of the issues that we found in Texas was the issue of gerrymandering and drawing up political boundaries to seek a partisan advantage. Both Democrats and Republicans have done it, but now we have seen that this drawing, redistricting and drawing up of some of these political boundaries had unintended consequences of impacting minorities, African Americans, Hispanics. So these are issues that are controversial. They are also being challenged in the court, and people are looking for other alternatives to the gerrymandering process.
Turning back to you, Mark Lagon of the Freedom House, do you think that some of these actions, these voter ID laws, restrictions to voting and gerrymandering, as Chris mentioned, are reminiscent, if less overtly racially motivated, of the poll taxes and literacy tests of the segregated era?
Well, it's good to disentangle this. I mean, people have been trying to increase the voter ID card requirements, ostensibly because of voter fraud. They're really isn't evidence that has been published anywhere of systematic voter fraud. So, you know, one has to wonder about the motivation. I think the most problematic barrier placed in political participation are those things that would deter people from being able to exercise the vote. Gerrymandering is troubling, but it sometimes has unintended consequences. Sometimes districts have been set up for the purpose of making sure that a minority person is elected, and it's had the unintended consequence of making other adjacent districts more easily won by Republicans. So sometimes tinkering has unintended consequences.
And to you, John Greenbaum, for your take on what are considered challenges to the 1965 law.
Yeah, I was one of the lawyers trying to defend the Voting Rights Act in that Supreme Court case of 2 years ago, when it was very disappointing day when the majority of the Supreme Court struck down the protections of Section 5. And one of the cases that we had won in the lower court under Section 5 was Texas's voter ID law, considered to be the most restrictive government-issued photo ID law in the country. And in that case, Texas had the burden of showing that law was not discriminatory. Well, one of the things that we and the federal government did after that is we had to file a case in federal court in Texas. Now the law was in effect, and to try to stop the law. And we won in the trial court, but the Supreme Court said that Texas could still go forward with the voter ID law in the 2014 elections. And then Texas at the same time appealed the case. And just Wednesday, the day before the 50th anniversary, the court found in our favor that Texas's voter ID law violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act because it has a discriminatory effect against both African Americans and Latinos.
Back to you, Chris Simpkins. Talk about which states, in addition, of course, to Texas, which we just talked about, and whose strict voter identification law was now struck down, what other states are challenging the spirit and letter of the 1965 law?
Well, one of the states is where I'm from, North Carolina, which both sides wrapped up their cases, and we should expect a decision from the court down there as to some of their requirements that North Carolina's legislature imposed, which was a reduction of registration days, a reduction of the time of early voting. Also, North Carolina has a voter ID law as well. So all of those are under challenge. Also, there are cases pending in Wisconsin, Ohio, and Georgia.
Turning back to you, Mark Lagon, for your perspective on, you know, these challenges, these types of voter IDs and so forth, and, you know, what are the patterns in other countries around the world, other countries compared to the United States?
Well, it's a good question. You know, in talking about the effort to create photo ID barriers, you know, it's not unreasonable that people be asked to show some form of ID. It just shouldn't be gamed so that it is terribly hard. In Europe, they typically have national ID cards. Well, some of the very advocates of these ID requirements for elections here wouldn't be in favor of a national ID card themselves. But we should look at things in perspective. For instance, in Europe, there is a lot less minority representation in legislatures. Very few elected politicians who are Muslim or who are of African background. So we have made a good deal of progress here in the United States. There are two patterns in the world that Freedom House sees. One is similar to the problems that the Voting Rights Act was intended to deal with, marginalized groups being squashed in their voice, actually being prevented from taking part in elections. But there are other insidious methods used by illiberal leaders around the world to block political participation, whether it's an overly high requirement of what percentage of the vote you need to get for your party to be represented in parliament, such as in Nicaragua and Russia, state resources being applied to support the ruling party. Some much more flagrant forms of gerrymandering exist in some places, even in Central Europe and Hungary. In the 2015 election, the ruling party of Viktor Orban won only 50% of the vote, but two-thirds of the parliamentary seats because of striking gerrymandering. And finally, you know, true intimidations, violence against people, such as in Zimbabwe, where the government speaks out against that violence committed against their opponents, but then there's impunity and no one's ever punished.
Indeed. Well, it's good to be reminded that notwithstanding our many flaws here in the United States, that there are many other countries where gross violations of people's right to vote are being committed. And at any rate, let me get back to our other guest, John Greenbaum. Do you have anything to add or subtract with respect to which states are actually challenging the spirit and letter of the 1965 law, and how serious is this? To what extent do you think state of North Carolina or others, to what extent this presents a major rollback of rights gained since 1965?
Well, I think you look at a lot of the places that were covered by Section 5 before, Mississippi, Louisiana, states like that, where there's been a history of discrimination. Section 5 was a great protection because one of the jurisdictions there would have to go to the Department of Justice or the federal court and demonstrate that a voting change is not discriminatory. And one of the things that that had the effect of doing was making people aware that voting changes were going on and serving as protection. I used to work at DOJ, as you mentioned, and one of the things that we would do is we would call minority contacts in the community and said, hey, have you heard about this polling place change? Have you heard about this redistricting? Did you have an opportunity to have input? Now, you know, a lot of the big danger is that a lot of changes that may affect people's ability to vote may happen in situations where they're not even aware. And in a lot of these small towns, small counties, school boards, there might be things going on that we don't even know about.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Mark Lagon, president of Freedom House, John Greenbaum, from whom you just heard. He's chief counsel and senior deputy director at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and Chris Simpkins, senior VOA TV reporter. We're discussing the significance of the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act and to what extent its tenets are on trial to this day. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. Well, back to you, our very own Chris Simpkins. And Chris, let's talk about the politics that may be going on. At root, to what extent do you think that current challenges to the Voting Rights Act of 1965 represent an attempt by politicians in states, particularly controlled by Republicans, to actually depress the vote of African Americans and other minorities who overwhelmingly vote for Democrats. Is that what really is going on behind these voting barriers enacted in such states like North Carolina?
Well, some of the state leaders and legislators who are mostly Republican would deny that. They, again, say that these laws are meant to protect the integrity of the vote, to guard against voter fraud. Others in these particular states have said that we have come a long way in 50 years and that these states have taken steps to ensure the integrity of the vote and that they should not be punished by being placed under these sections of the Voting Rights Act. So they would maintain that they're doing everything that they should to protect the vote and thus provide an environment where people feel good about voting taking place.
Turning to you, Mark Lagon, president of Freedom House, to what extent do you think there's some politics involved here, where you see a pattern, perhaps, of some Republican-controlled states who, again, under the pretext of preventing voter fraud, are really intending to sort of depress the vote of those, particularly Black Americans and other minorities, who would normally vote Democrat?
Sadly, it's human nature among those involved in politics to try and increase the chance of their party winning. You know, let's look at the North Carolina case that Chris Simpkin's study identifies. On the heels of the Supreme Court decision striking down the Section 5 requirements of preclearance, any one of those actions of the North Carolina legislature, one could perhaps argue for on the merits, ending same-day voter registration, stopping pre-registration of 16 or 17-year-olds, cutting back on early voting from 17 to 10 days, stopping voting on Sundays. Maybe religious people think that's inappropriate, but of course it's when Black churches mobilize African-American voters. You could offer some arguments on each of those, but the whole series of them taken together shows an intent. It's obviously trying to constrain the ability of African-Americans and minorities to hear their voice.
John Greenbaum, is this an effort to constrain and diminish, curtail the ability of African-Americans and other minorities who normally vote for Democrats? Is that what's going on in your view?
Well, one of the things that you can see in North Carolina, when you register, they ask you to identify your race. So one of the things that you saw with some of these changes, particularly the same-day registration and the expanded early voting, was that African-Americans proportionally turned out to vote more early and to more often use the same-day registration than white voters. So you could see a clear sort of racial impact towards opening up the ballot in that way. And, you know, you would think that the people that were drafting this law were very aware of that fact and so crafted a law that was designed in many ways to decrease African-American turnout. I mean, one of the other interesting things about North Carolina was right before the trial started, they decided to water down their voter ID law and allow people to vote by presenting an affidavit attesting to their identity. And implicit in that was they didn't need to have such a restrictive law in the first place, that there was no need for it. And it was only on the eve of trial that they said, okay, now that this case is going to trial, we need to have something that's going to be less draconian. I mean, the idea of having a voter ID law in itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's when that law becomes disenfranchising for people who are eligible voters that it becomes a problem.
And indeed, and that's what many people are saying that this 2013 Supreme Court ruling has been doing. So back to you, Chris Simpkins. What is Congress doing to fight back? We know that there are a couple of pieces of legislation being considered.
Yeah, and I was spent some time on Capitol Hill recently talking to John Lewis, one of the big backers of this proposed legislation that's in the House of Representatives that would restore certain criteria back to the Voting Rights Act, certain sections and provisions that were taken out in the Supreme Court case in 2013. But they see this as an uphill battle because the Congress is controlled by Republicans who really are not eager to push forward this proposed legislation. And so it's very uncertain, but talking to Congressman Lewis, who was deeply involved in the voting rights struggle in Selma, Alabama 50 years ago, he thinks that if measures aren't taken to correct what the Supreme Court did, then it's going to turn the country backwards, and it's going to be a big defeat for democracy.
Turning to you, Mark Leghorn, what is your view of the number of initiatives being proposed by Congress to fight back against the Supreme Court ruling of 2013? There's a bipartisan Voting Rights Amendment Act, and it's been reintroduced by both a Democrat and Republican, and now a Voting Rights Advancement Act, sponsored by two Democrats. Both measures offer updated criteria on this so-called preclearance formula. Do you think that that's justified, these types of measures?
Well, maybe my comment reflects having been a House and Senate aide in the past, but I really do think it, you know, it's the legislative branch that needs to take the responsibility. If they feel that the legacy of the Voting Rights Act needs to be staunched, strengthened, they're the ones to do it. I think we sometimes look to the Supreme Court to solve or to shape law, but it really is the role of Congress to do this. And I hope, you know, if we want to strengthen protections of people to be able to assert their voice, Congress will do its job.
Turning to you, John Greenbaum, are you confident that Congress can perhaps roll back these restrictive provisions?
If they can get through Congress, absolutely. I think the difficulty, though, is it's politically deadlocked. And right now, there hasn't even been a hearing held with respect to the Voting Rights Advancement Act. So if Congress isn't even holding hearings regarding this, and you ultimately have to have a legislative record to back up legislation against constitutional challenge, then we can't get anywhere.
And as we conclude, Chris Simpkins, what message do you think the apparent manipulation of the Voting Rights Act by states with introducing voter identification and other restrictive measures sends to the world?
Well, not a very good message, I think. Personally, I think that what has happened over the course of time is that these states have adopted instruments that make it more difficult to vote rather than easier. And I think we should be looking at ways to make it easier. Granted, registering to vote and voting, there are more polling places. We have social media to announce voting polling places. We have easier methods to register. But we should not be, probably, in my opinion, adopting laws that are going to make it harder for people to get to the polls. And because it's harder, they don't want to show up. And that's the thing. If you register and don't show up, it's a shame.
Mark Leghorn, why do many other countries around the world, first of all, make voting mandatory, for one? And then why does the United States delegate rules that govern such an important part of our democratic tradition, voting and elections, to the states rather than give it to federal government?
Well, like some other countries in the world, we have a federal system. I remember when I was the anti-human trafficking ambassador, I used to talk to officials in India about solving the problem of bonded labor. And they said, well, like you, we give power to our states and our federal government can't make it happen. We have that tradition, but that doesn't mean we should stand aside when there's basic access to justice or political voice that's being denied. And that's why the Voting Rights Act was passed 50 years ago. The federal government at times does have to step in and set some parameters.
And the last word to you, John Greenbaum, with respect to any kind of message, perhaps the difficulties we're experiencing now in trying to keep the Voting Rights Act of 1965 as strong as it had been. What final thoughts do you have with respect to what message this sends to the world?
Well, people look up to America in terms of our principles of democracy and equality. And if in our country we still have these issues regarding racial discrimination and voting, it's really sort of a black eye. And we need to fully deal with the issues of discrimination and voting. And we need to do things that are going to really create an environment in which we have higher turnout in elections. And, you know, when I've spoken to people from a lot of the countries in Europe, our turnout is actually much lower than in a lot of those countries. And we have to really think about ways to encourage people to vote as opposed to discourage people to vote.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this special edition of Encounter. Well, when we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, I'd like to thank my guests, Mark Leghorn, president of Freedom House, John Greenbaum, chief counsel and senior deputy director at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and our very own Chris Simpkins, VOA senior TV reporter. Gentlemen, thank you all for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Chiang Wong, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.